Today is Friday, January 17th, and this is the VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Taliban and U.S. negotiators met to discuss the signing of a peace deal.
Whatever kind of partial ceasefire the Taliban has offered apparently is, being positively considered by the U.S. team.
Plus, an upcoming Berlin summit aims to halt Libya's civil war. And Australian firefighters have saved a rare tree species from the country's raging bushfires. Those stories and more are next. Taliban and U.S. negotiators met Wednesday and Thursday to discuss the signing of a peace deal. During the talks, the Taliban said it will implement a temporary ceasefire if it reaches an agreement with U.S. negotiators. If they sign an agreement, it could revive hopes for a long-term solution to the war in Afghanistan. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad to get the details.
What we understand as of this moment from the Taliban side, their political negotiating team spokesman Sohail Shaheen has issued a brief statement saying that the negotiations that they have held over the past 2 days and which will continue even as we speak right now and will continue for some more days, have focused on signing of the agreement and arranging a ceremony for this event, which suggests that whatever kind of partial ceasefire the Taliban has offered apparently is, being positively considered by the U.S. team.
You mentioned a partial ceasefire. Do we have any details that the Taliban or the U.S. Negotiators have released about what that may entail? Because in the past, a ceasefire has not been issued by the Taliban during the talks or during the conflict.
Yes, that has been the main issue or the issue because of which the dialogue had been deadlocked, that the Taliban they were continuing their attacks inside Afghanistan against Afghans and U.S. coalition forces while they were holding negotiations. And that is why Zalmay Khalilzad, the chief U.S. negotiator, last month paused the dialogue and demanded that the Taliban must hold, must stop hostilities so that they can, finalize the deal. So it seems that the Taliban realized the U.S. seriousness that if they do not cease hostilities, there may not be an agreement at the end of the day. But now that the Taliban is offering from its side a partial ceasefire, and let me explain what is a partial ceasefire. What we understand from the Taliban sources is there would be no, attacks inside Afghanistan, battlefield attacks or suicide bombings. For a period of between 7 to 10 days, so that there is a justification for the United States to sign this agreement. But this partial ceasefire is not, the Taliban has not promised to stop attacks against Afghan security forces during this partial ceasefire. It is primarily meant to send a message to the international community that if U.S. and NATO forces withdraw from Afghanistan and if they will start such a process, Taliban insurgents will not attack that process and instead facilitate that process by not conducting any violent activities. But one thing which is important that once this agreement between the United States and the Taliban is signed to end the war, once it is signed, it will immediately lead to starting of a dialogue process between the Taliban and Afghan stakeholders, and that is when the Taliban will announce a nationwide ceasefire. So, again, this is the step one.
That was reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad speaking to my colleague Steve Miller. On Sunday, Germany will host a summit of foreign powers and the rival Libyan armed groups they back to try to end the war over Tripoli and resume talks on a power-sharing deal. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will attend the Libya conference in Berlin. The conference will come days after failed efforts by Russia and Turkey to persuade rebel general and U.S. citizen Khalifa Haftar, whose forces control much of Libya's east and south, to agree to a lasting ceasefire and halt his offensive on the Libyan capital. Haftar left Moscow without signing the proposal. Today, he made a surprise visit to Greece in a bid to gain Athens' support against Turkey, whose military is backing Haftar's military rivals, ahead of the Berlin conference. United Nations officials have criticized international involvement in Libya's war, which has drawn fighters or weapons from Turkey, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Sudan, despite a UN arms embargo. VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi spoke with Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute, about Haftar's ambitions and Turkey as a counterbalance to fend his attempt on Tripoli.
When Haftar announced his coup or putsch, sometimes called Operation Dignity, in 2014, it had no legal basis. But the more power he gained, the more foreign supporters he had, all of a sudden, he got appointed field marshal by the House of Representatives. As soon as he was field marshal, he got invited to conferences, first in France and then in Italy. And that has snowballed into legitimacy, so much so that international talks consider him as almost a co-equal side with Fayez Sarraj, who is the quote-unquote legitimate prime minister of Libya. And in terms of what he wants, I don't think what he wants is simple, because he could have achieved power in Libya merely by playing along with the national conference process or the UN push for elections. What he wants is something, you know, more megalomaniacal than that. He wants to be acclaimed supreme leader. I think the model is more like Sisi in Egypt, whereby an army can then make property deals, can do construction projects, and has no check and balance on its power. Because he had already won prior to his assault on Tripoli, because he's controlling 90% of the country's oil and 70%+ of its territory, and was going to win any election that would happen. It's very bizarre that he tried to win over the last population center that he didn't control, and he had no chance, and has made Libya descend further and further into this unwinnable and very tragic civil war with the humanitarian consequences you already outlined.
Yeah, Egypt is backing Haftar's role in dismantling militias as he requested in Moscow. What could that lead to?
So the idea that Haftar has an army and all his opponents are mere militias is propaganda. In Libya, there really is no state. I would argue that rather than being two states or two governments, we have zero states. He has a coalition of militias that are slightly more centralized, and they fight another coalition of militias. Look at them as the LNA and anti-LNA coalitions. It's very convenient if you label your enemy as militias and then say, I will only accept a ceasefire if they are dismantled. So that's not a starter as an ask. And simultaneously, the GNA has a non-starter for its preconditions for the ceasefire to move into real peace talks, which is reverting to the pre-April military lines, you know, so that anyone who made any gains has to go backwards. Those are non-starters, and that's why I look at the Moscow ceasefire talks as something like a media exercise. The Russians want them to show that they are prima inter pares and that the buck stops in Moscow and not in Washington or London or Rome. And the two sides, the LNA and anti-LNA coalition, all they really want to achieve is showing, I got him to agree to my talking points, moving forward on the real issues, which are economic and structural, hopefully at the Berlin conference on Sunday, January 19th.
But Turkish President Erdogan said Turkey will not refrain from teaching Haftar a lesson if he continues attacks against Libya's government and people. Would Turkey intervene militarily if Haftar continued his military campaign toward Tripoli?
So Turkey already has intervened militarily, and I would argue that Turkey is the most vested and involved of any of the powers and sides. What has happened gradually is that in the first Libyan civil war, and that's the period 2014 to 2015, Libyan actors fought each other but had outside support. What's happened in the second Libyan civil war is almost unprecedented in human history. The various outside actors fight each other on Libyan territory. We have the world's first extraterritorial drone war. The UAE pilots the drones, and the Turkish pilot their drones. Libyans are not involved in choosing the targets or in flying the drones themselves. So when Erdogan makes the threat that you mentioned, It's extremely credible.
That was Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute, speaking to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshinawi. Russia has rapidly expanded its arms deals around the world in the last 5 years, having signed military cooperation pacts with 39 countries during that time. There's been a special focus by Russia on countries in Southeast Asia, including Laos. International Edition's managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, spoke with journalist Luke Hunt about Moscow's activity in the region.
Well, there was the pullout after the Cold War, and then they made their presence felt again, really, in the 2000s. And then with the collapse of the ruble in 2014, which followed sanctions imposed by America following the dispute over the Ukraine, there was this enormous pullback. Now, over that period, we've seen a decline in weapons sales to India, which is a big kind of weapons sales market for the Russians, and the Americans certainly remain the dominant force. But in terms of pushing back around the world, the Deputy Foreign Minister Foeman recently said that they'd made military contracts with 39 countries around the world, and particularly across Central and Southeast Asia. So we're talking from Sri Lanka to Indonesia, Cambodia. Vietnam has always been a big taker of Russian weapons, but also the Philippines are making inroads, and Myanmar as well.
How has this changed then in recent years?
Around the world, there's only two countries that dominate the high-tech weaponry market, and that's the United States and the Russians. And the Americans impose a lot of conditions on sales. The sales are tied to human rights, they're tied to sanctions, they're tied to, you know, old-fashioned rivalries, that kind of thing. Now, the Russians are offering barter deals. They're a lot cheaper. They're big on spares and servicing, that kind of thing. And so for countries, say, like Laos, where they are making big inroads, they're particularly appealing. Now, Laos is interesting. They've sent over a batch of tanks, Yak fighter jets, helicopters, and they've conducted their first military drills. The main suspicion for this, the Russians aren't really forthcoming in telling you why they do anything, but the Laos are building massive railways across the country, which are tying up with Thailand, Vietnam, and Cambodia. And as we know, the Russians are always on the lookout for warm water ports. And by tying up with Laos, they'll be getting access to the railroads and access to ports. And one way they can do that is through weapon sales.
But what else is driving the change in Russian arms sales and military contact in the region?
No, there's two schools of thought. One is that the push into Southeast Asia and elsewhere, including Africa, is that it's purely commercial, that the Russian economy is, I don't know if it's quite on its knees, but it's certainly been hurting since 2014. And this is one thing they're very good at. And so the first school of thought is that it is purely commercial. The other school of thought is that it is strategy, and that it's all about pushing out, making Russia great again, if I can use that term. But it's about getting out there, competing with the United States. And also after 2014, Russia was isolated, and the only way they can beat that isolation is to be proactive in areas which they're good at. Now, the problem with this, as some scholars are saying, is that we are starting to see a bit of an alignment between Russia and China. Now, if that was to harden, if we were to see Russia and China get together and have military alliances back in Southeast Asia, we could see, I wouldn't necessarily say a Cold War, a repetition of that, but we could see a return to that kind of standoff between governments and alliances.
That was journalist Luke Hunt speaking with International Edition's Kate Pound Dawson. The Senate impeachment trial of U.S. President Donald Trump begins Tuesday. Trump has named members of his defense team as Democrats gear up to try to overcome Republican control of the Senate. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson is on the line with the latest. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
So first, who is on Trump's defense team, and what do they bring to the table?
Well, he's just named seven members of his defense team, and they include some really high-profile names, including Alan Dershowitz, who will be recognizable to many Americans as part of the O.J. Simpson legal defense team more than two decades ago, as well as another person who was high profile in the 1990s, Ken Starr, who was actually the independent prosecutor who prosecuted Bill Clinton, which of course led to his impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. So a lot of bold-faced names in that defense team for the president.
Now, this week, the government's accountability office said Trump broke the law with his actions on Ukraine, and Lev Parnas, who is an associate of the president's personal lawyer, has shared information that adds to the evidence against Trump. But so far, it looks like Senate Republicans are standing by the president. Do the Democrats have a strategy to overcome the Republican majority in the Senate?
That's right. So Democrats were saying that this was part of their strategy in holding back the articles of impeachment, is that that delay from when they impeached the president in the U.S. House in December and from when they transmitted the articles of impeachment just this past week allowed time for some of this new evidence to emerge. And also, more importantly, for public opinion to build in their favor. They argue that Republicans will have to call witnesses and allow those documents into the trial because public opinion has been building towards that. People here in America, they say, are asking for more transparency in that Senate trial.
Okay, we've got about a minute, 15 seconds left. The impeachment trial comes at a critical time in the U.S. presidential race. Four senators are running to be the Democratic presidential candidate, and they're going to have to pause their campaigns to join this Senate trial next week. How might that affect the race?
Well, we've actually already seen that affect the race because we saw Senator Cory Booker withdraw just this past week, citing funding issues, but also saying that because he needed to be here in Washington, D.C., he just wouldn't be able to get out on the campaign trail ahead of the crucial first nominating contest in Iowa, the Iowa caucuses, which will be in early February. He said that, you know, this is part of his duty as a senator, but it just was an added pressure on his campaign. Of course, we know that some of the front runners, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who are also senators and who will be stuck here in Washington, D.C., have a little bit of more of a lead in the polls. But obviously, it's an advantage to former Vice President Joe Biden and others who will be campaigning hard in the weeks leading up to the caucus.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Thank you for joining us.
You're so welcome.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers at the California Institute of Technology's Zwicky Transient Facility, or ZTF, have discovered the first asteroid to orbit entirely within the orbit of Venus. Called 2020 AV2, the space rock is classified by scientists as an Atiris asteroid, which are objects whose orbits fall completely within Earth's orbit. With this discovery, there are now 21 of these Atiris asteroids circling the Sun. Actually, 2020 AV2 is also considered the first known Vatira asteroid, with a V meaning Venus. Caltech's George Helou, executive director of the IPAC Astronomy Center at Caltech and a co-investigator at ZTF, says the asteroid must have traveled toward Venus from further out in the solar system, and if it leaves its current orbit, will probably crash into Venus or Mercury. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin. Iran's supreme leader lashed out at Western countries during Friday prayers in Tehran. In a fiery speech, his first at the weekly prayer service in 8 years, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei dismissed American clowns, that's a quote, who he said pretend to support the Iranian nation, but want to stick their, quote, poison dagger, unquote, into his back. He insisted Iran would not bow to U.S. pressure after months of crushing sanctions and a series of recent crises, from the killing of a top Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani, by an American airstrike to the accidental shootdown of a Ukrainian passenger plane by Iran. An ancient rare species of tree has been saved from Australia's bushfires by a specialist team of firefighters. The grove of Walemi pines, which predate the dinosaurs, was threatened by blazes in the Blue Mountains west of Sydney. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia's Wallamai pines survived the dinosaurs and were protected from huge blazes near Sydney by waterbombing aircraft and specialist firefighters who were winched into a narrow gorge by helicopter. The New South Wales Environment Minister is Matt Keane.
It was a military-style operation. We had fire retardant, irrigation systems. We winched staff into the area to make sure that we were doing everything we could to protect the trees. And fortunately, it paid off. These trees can be found nowhere else in the world. In fact, there's only 200 left on the planet. So we needed to do everything we could to protect them and ensure that they were able to survive into the future.
The Wallamai National Park near Sydney is the only place in the world where these giant trees are found in the wild. Before 1994, they were thought to be extinct. Experts believe the pines are an invaluable link to Australia's prehistoric past and have estimated the grove could be up to 200 million years old. Their exact location is a secret because of fears that visitors could bring in pathogens that might cause disease. Some trees were charred by the flames, and about two were destroyed. But this rare species has survived Australia's bushfire crisis. It is a rare piece of good news. 29 people have died in the disaster. Hundreds of homes have been lost, and it's estimated that more than a billion animals have been killed. Heavy rain has fallen across southeastern Australia, offering some relief for fire crews battling dozens of blazes. But there are concerns the wet weather could cause landslides and flash flooding. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thousands of people who fled from around the active Taal volcano in the Philippines made a dash back home Friday to retrieve their belongings. Local officials made the call to temporarily drop evacuation orders, fearing residents would struggle to get by without their possessions, especially livestock. Reuters' Lauren Anthony reports.
Thousands of volcano evacuees in the Philippines were allowed back to their homes in a danger zone on Friday. A long line of cars drove through a blanket of ash to grab belongings and rescue animals before volcano Taal explodes. It was a temporary reprieve ordered by the mayor of a local town while it's still calm. He told Reuters that without necessities and critically their livestock, residents would struggle to survive. It's been nearly a week since the Taal volcano rumbled to life, upending the lives of thousands.
For us residents, it's hard to leave. It's hard to leave our homes and livelihood behind.
But not everyone here has waited for official permission. Earlier in the week, some residents defied authorities to retrieve some of the 3,000 or so horses trapped on the volcanic island. Most of the animals had been rented out to tourists for a fee.
The horses are our livelihood. If we are not able to save them, we won't be able to get back on our feet.
More than 66,000 people have been forced to move to evacuation centres since Taal began spewing ash and steam on Sunday. Experts warn it's still in danger of exploding over the coming days.
That was Lauren Anthony from Reuters. China's economic growth sank to a new multi-decade low in 2019 as Beijing fought a tariff war with Washington, according to government data. The world's second-largest economy grew by 6.1%, down from 2018's 6.6%, already the lowest since 1990. Growth in the 3 months ending in December held steady at the previous quarter's level of 6% over a year earlier. Forecasters said a U.S.-Chinese trade truce might help to revive consumer and business activity. And Russia's foreign policy chief on Friday blamed what he described as, quote, aggressive, unquote, U.S. policies for growing global tensions, noting Washington's reluctance to extend a key nuclear arms pact. Sergey Lavrov, who serves as acting foreign minister in the wake of Wednesday's resignation of the Russian cabinet, said this week's meeting of top U.S. and Russian diplomats on strategic stability didn't achieve any immediate results, adding that, quote, dialogue is continuing, end quote. And that's going to do it for us today. This was International Edition. On behalf of our director, Jackson Mlungani, and engineer, PJ Elliott, thank you for listening to The Voice of America. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can also find archives copies of the show on the program page under the Live Radio tab. Until next time, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington.